This episode is sponsored by a company I've used for well over a decade, and that is 5.11. I wore their uniforms back in Anaheim, California, and have used their products ever since. From their incredibly strong yet light footwear to their cut uniforms for both male and female responders, I found them hands down the best workwear in all the departments that I've worked for. Outside of the fire service, I use their luggage for everything and I travel a lot, and they are also now sponsoring the 7X team as we embark around the world on the Human Performance Project. We have MRF coming up in May, and again, I bought their plate carrier. I ended up buying real ballistic plates rather than the fake weight plates, and that has been my ride or die through MRF the last few years as well. But one area I want to talk about that I haven't in previous sponsorship spots is their brick and mortar element. They were predominantly an online company up till more recently, but now they are approaching 100 stores all over the US. My local store is here in Gainesville, Florida, and I've been multiple times. And the discounts you see online are applied also in the stores. So as I mentioned, 5.11 is offering you 15% off every purchase that you make. But I do want to say, more often than not, they have an even deeper discount, especially around holiday times. But if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, you will get 15% off your order or in the stores every time you make a purchase. And if you want to hear more about 5.11, who they stand for and who works with them, listen to episode 580 of Behind the Shield podcast with 5.11 regional director, Will Ayers. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show former firefighter and co-founder of the Siren Project, Angela Graham Howling. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from Angela's journey into the fire service, the power of mentorship, diversity, some career calls, her powerful mental health journey, how psychedelic therapy helped pull her from her darkness, using her own experience to create a nonprofit that ultimately connects other first responders with this kind of treatment, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Angela Graham Howling. Enjoy. Well, Angela, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you so much for providing this platform and having us.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
I am in Carmel Valley, California, the one near Monterey, not the one near San Diego. Apparently there's two.
All right, beautiful. Well, I want to start at the very beginning of your timeline. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
Born and raised in California and in Concord, actually, which is just East Bay of Oakland. And my father was a mechanic till I was 10. And then he went to work for Chevron Oil Refinery as an operator. My mom is an RDA, registered dental assistant. Now she's an office manager for dental offices. I have one brother, call him my little brother, 6 years younger, but he's about 6'8", probably 3 bills. He's a big boy. He's a big boy. That's a little bit of where I come from.
What did your dad's work week look like or work year look like on the refineries? And there's a reason why I'm asking that.
It was rough. My mom had the schedule memorized. I never got it. It was something like 4 on, 3 off, 3 on, 4 off. Then it was always a 12-hour shift. So he would do like 4 days and then have 3 days off and then 4 nights and then have 3 days off. It was a really hard schedule to follow. So I think by the time I was 10, I was used to somebody working graveyards overnight.
Yeah, because the reason I ask, I actually put a post up recently, and it was just, I'm really trying to push for the 2472 to be a national industry standard for us. Get the firefighters working a normal work week that actually, you know, creates health rather than disease. And I put a post, and it just said that, what did it say? Administrators that work 40 hours continuously vote against firefighters working less than 56. And one guy chimed in, and it was actually hidden by Instagram, funny enough, and he was like, I work 83 hours a week on the refinery. Stop bitching. You signed up for it. And I'm like, because that obviously always fixes things when you just say shut up and don't address it. But for right. me, when I think of the oil rigs, a lot of times I think about working, you know, a few months at a time and then going off for a few months. And then obviously doing the same thing for 10, 20, 30 years unending is very different than, you know, doing seasons on a rig or a crab fishing boat, for example.
Yeah. He wasn't in the seasons. He was at the refinery. So he wasn't like off on a rig where they were drilling for it. So he was just kind of, I just remember thinking it'd be so much easier on their bodies if they just did all night shifts for a month and then switched to all day shifts for a month or something that to give them a chance to get into a rhythm. Cause just doing four nights and off for 3 days and then right into 4 days and like almost every week you're changing graveyard to day shifts. And it's not like us, like sometimes we sleep at night on our 24s. When they're up at night and working, they're actually working, doing stuff. So it's hard. It's hard on the body, lack of sleep. Sleep is not overrated.
No.
For sure.
Absolutely. All right. What about sports? What were you playing when you were young?
Oh, I started softball really young. I want to say I was 4 or 5. And I played all the way through college on scholarship, Division I. And then I had the opportunity to play professionally overseas in Italy. And we got to play against the U.S. Olympic team. It's pretty awesome. And I played a little volleyball in high school and then college. And it was just, it's too hard to play two sports in college. And that was just my fun sport. Now I'm more into horses. It's a little more therapeutic. I wouldn't say it's easier on the body at all, but there's definitely a mindfulness to working with horses. Just like in softball, I was a pitcher. So you had to be very in tune with your body and you had to have those moments of focus. And I didn't realize how cathartic pitching had been. Even though it was my job and towards the end of my career, I didn't really love it anymore. There's days where you go out there and you're just throwing the ball around and you're just focused on you and you kind of get a chance to forget about everything else. So I'm glad I have horses now.
I grew up with horses and was not a great rider. It probably sent me on a good path to being a stuntman, which I did alongside fire service. But yeah, I was terrible. But that meant I was always getting thrown from, you know, over ditches and over fences and anywhere the horse decided to suddenly stop and I kept going.
You learn how to tuck and roll for
you
sure.
What about career aspirations? What were you dreaming of becoming while you were in the school age?
Oh, I wanted to be a helicopter pilot. I just went to college to get a degree. Didn't matter what it was in, because then you could join the military as an officer or a warrant officer, and then you could fly. And then I actually fractured two vertebrae, the processes of two vertebrae on a dirt bike right before I actually joined the army, signed in, sworn and everything. And then before I got shipped out, I fractured two vertebrae and I was medically disqualified to fly. So they're like, you can still join the army. You just can't fly. I'm like, yeah, that's all right. So I didn't do my second swear in and actually ship off. And I think I landed on my feet. I did all right.
Absolutely. Well then, so walk me through that. You play professionally for a moment in Italy. You know, what was that experience like as far as a softball first, and especially playing against your national side?
Oh, it was amazing. That was awesome. I'm pretty sure every girl who plays softball or any sport would love to play with or against the Olympic team, the best of the best. And I did pretty well. I struck out Crystal Bustos all three times I faced her. I struck out Lisa Fernandez. So I just have to brag about that for a moment. She's kind of like the Babe Ruth of softball. So that was amazing. And then just getting to live in another country and learn another language, I truly experienced culture shock and what it's like to just, by the end of the day, I was like, don't talk to me in Italian anymore. I was just mentally exhausted, but I was comfortable in conversations in 2 or 3 months in and just learning a whole other way of life. And I remember thinking, these people just truly enjoy every day. They're so present. They don't have that rat race competition that we have of competitiveness in America. And it was a really nice energy to be around for a year. And softball was fun. My teammates were awesome. They all had other jobs. This was just what they did for fun. So it wasn't super, super serious, but we had cadet teams. So I got to work with the little kids. And believe it or not, off topic a little bit, the kids were the best teachers of Italian, because when you ask an adult a question on a word or grammar, they get all complicated with conjugation and all this stuff. When you ask a child, how do you say this? They're just very simple with it. Like, I just need nouns and verbs to get by. And so I think coaching the cadets and the little girls was where I learned the most Italian, because we're all talking about body parts and how to move them and doing the mechanics of pitching or hitting. And you get to know these little people, even though you don't really understand everything they're saying, you get to know who they are based on the mannerisms, and you find you're more in tune with people when you don't understand what they're saying.
Absolutely.
It was great.
Well, it's interesting you say about the kind of presence. I find the same in Portugal. I'm actually about to go back there. A couple of my family members moved there about 20 years ago. And it's such a slow country. And I mean that affectionately. Like, everything is just at a much lower pace, but they're actually very progressive. Like, for example, they decriminalized addiction, which we got to know we're going to get into later. So, you know, lesser known fact about somewhere that's kind of looked down its nose a little bit from other kind of snootier countries. But when I think of Italy, I also think about, I think it's one of the blue zones is there. So some of the healthiest people come from parts of Italy. What was your experience as far as kind of exercise or movement, more importantly, and then the food that was there?
Well, I was living in Parma, and that was pretty flat, but most of my teammates came from all over the country. And it was just known, like, your midday siesta, you're going to go for a walk. After a meal, you're going to go for a walk. And they have little town center parks where people are just out there doing kind of like swinging their arms around and just moving their bodies all the time. And there was definitely a mentality of moderation, in the sense of, we can have wine and we can have prosciutto and we can have all the stuff that's not good for us, but we don't eat ourselves till we're fat. We just enjoy little bits of stuff. So it was a good habit. I think it built in some good habits to observe that, hey, I can have a little bit of all this stuff you're not supposed to have. You just don't go all in. And they're big on, you know, olive oil, not butter, and seafood. And believe it or not, and when you talk about the blue zones, it's not just about the food you eat and your exercise. It's about community. A lot of those blue zones talk about how you have your family and your network and your people. And Italians are very social. Every meal every meal is family style, and it's a whole 2-hour ordeal. You don't just quick eat in 20 minutes and get going. They really take the time to not only enjoy their food, but to enjoy each other. And I know that's one of the qualities of the Blue Zone, and that was definitely prevalent when I was there.
Beautiful. I'm glad I asked that. One more thing I kind of skipped over with your early life. Obviously, we're going to get into mental health and struggles. One of the massive realizations that really kind of showed its face as I started doing hundreds of these interviews was the impact on our early life, on our resilience, or maybe some struggles when we put the uniform on. When you reflect now with this kind of wise lens that you have, were there any elements of your upbringing you think that contributed to some of the struggles later?
Oh, absolutely. My parents, bless their hearts, they were not compatible, probably from the beginning. They split up many times before they finally divorced when I was 25. I think they stayed together because they thought it was best for me and my brother. So they stuck it out, and as miserable as they were, it created a toxic, hostile environment where you're always tense, just waiting for the next fight, for someone to blow their top. And I'm certain I developed unhealthy coping mechanisms. So I didn't know how to adapt or how to communicate while you're stressed in a constructive manner. I just learned to yell or get mad or explode, because if I get mad and I explode, it pushes you back on your heels, and now you're no longer coming at me. So problem solved. It's not healthy, but in the immediacy right now, if I can say the harshest, meanest thing I can think of, it hurts your feelings. You walk away crying. Well, now I feel guilty, but that's a lot better than feeling enraged. I love my parents and they love us dearly and they did the best they could and they thought staying together was the best for us. And it absolutely contributed to probably some mental health issues as well as not healthy coping mechanisms.
Yeah, I think it's an important conversation. I mean, you know, when you talk about the fire service at the front door, we have a ridiculous psychological test that now, having interviewed many, many people in that field, have all said that it was never meant to be a standalone assessment for your ability to be a first responder. It's supposed to be part of a gamut of tests for forensic psychology. And that's the only discussion at the front door that we have. Now, in 2024, I've kind of put to people, rather than a polygraph and a psych test, which I did numerous times to different departments, how about you just take that money and from the front door, you give 6 counseling sessions in your probationary year. And now you've not only, you know, created a bond with a counselor, you've removed any of the barrier to entry, but you've given them an opportunity to start offloading some of the things and processing them before they start seeing all the horrible shit that we see.
And I think that there's, to piggyback on that, not only offer therapy at the beginning, we do want to clear people to make sure that they're mentally stable. There's no schizophrenia. There's no catastrophic mental health issues that are prevalent from the beginning, for sure. But we only get tested at the beginning. How often did you get fit tested? How many times were you tested on push-ups or pull-ups or something physical? I was tested every single year, but never again psychologically. And not in the mindset of, oh, you're unfit, let's pull you off the line, but how about a check-in? We did blood work. Do I have cancer? Am I getting my cholesterol? Like, we check in on our health physically, but nowhere in the fire department was there ever a standard to check in mentally. They're just completely relying on us to step up and say, I'm not okay, I need help. And as firefighters, we're not very good at that. We suck at that. So it would be interesting to see, maybe not just the money on to go towards therapy in the beginning, but maybe find a way to check in periodically, even if it's not every year, every other year, maybe every 3 years, just something. So you don't go through a 30-year career having no professionals check in on you. And maybe you're really great at coping and hiding it and none of your crew members check in on you either. And then you retire out and all the other horrible things that happen, we'll get into that later. But also in the beginning, not just, okay, let's do a test. Let's see where you sit mentally, emotionally, and having the therapy to help you work through that. How about developing tools? I mean, Benjamin Franklin said an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Why are we waiting until people are drowning and committing suicide or attempting suicide or going through divorces or becoming alcoholics before we're like, hey, let's go help these people? Why are we not teaching them in academy proper coping mechanisms that you could learn with those 6 therapy sessions, or you could learn as a group the same way you're learning how to work out and eat right? As firefighters, most of us have a pretty good idea on how to work out and eat right, but just like physical health, how many of us know how to take care of ourselves mentally with breath work and meditation and mindfulness practices? And I would really like to see that become a part of the academy, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I was actually part of an initiative here in Florida that was supposed to be putting that in. I don't even know what happened to it. The chief that was heading it ended up leaving the academy and going somewhere else. But, you know, even the sleep thing, I think one of the problems that we have is that people don't want to talk about sleep too much when they know damn well that they're the reason that their firefighters aren't sleeping. You know, that the schedule was so terrible. So that's always kind of footed around. It's always like, oh, well, they need to have good sleep hygiene on their days off. Oh, that's your solution? That's it? You know what I mean? So these are all such important pieces of the puzzle. But I agree completely. You know, there should be, you know, a normal conversation about the mental health and the tools and the tricks and the understanding that sleep hygiene, what that looks like, how to wind down at the end of the day, how to remove things that are going to keep you awake, whether you realize it or not. But then also simultaneously having those check-in sessions, not just the first year. I mean, I'm talking about throughout the year, but that's how you really initiate it is, you know, at the front door. Talk to me about that. What was your kind of road to the fire service and what were the kind of physical and mental health discussions when you entered?
Well, when I was floating around after dropping out of the army for flying, I just leaned back on really the only skill I had, which was softball. So I was just coaching. And one of the dads was a fire captain, and he told me I should look into this. And so I looked into it and decided, yeah, that sounds awesome. So got my EMT and got hired pretty quickly, got picked up out here, and went through the whole hiring process, the psych background. It was interesting because I laugh when they did the psych and you answer the questions. You know, it's really only 5 questions. They ask you 200 times in different ways to make sure your kids. Do you see yourself as a librarian? Would you like to be, all these abstract things? And I remember the therapist in the interview afterwards saying, so it looks here like you're an alcoholic. And I said, excuse me? He goes, well, you drank to excess to the point of throwing up. It said here, you did that. And I just laughed. I was like, well, it did go to college. So
that was a
there may have been a time when I had a little too much to drink and I got sick. And I just kind of laughed it off. And looking back, I don't think he was, I think he was trying to trigger me to see if it was a button, to see if I'd get defensive. So it was a game. I'm like, okay. So in no way, shape, or form was this individual trying to help me or see if I needed help. He was actually trying to trigger me, which was interesting. And yeah, academy sucked. I played Division I in professional softball, and I don't think I've ever been as stressed in my life as I was in academy, which is good because you want to know if you're going to freak out and crumble under pressure. I'd rather find out in academy than when I'm in a house on fire and I'm having to drag my buddy out or doing CPR on a 2-year-old. I'd rather know this about myself, that I'm not good under pressure now. But it was hard. It was stressful. The other woman in my academy didn't make it. I was the only one. And at one point in my department, I remember, and we have about 200, 220 online people, 15 stations. So we have a pretty good sized apartment. And I had almost reached my 10-year mark, and I was still our most junior female. None of the other females behind me had made it through academy or probation. They had all failed out. And part of me was kind of like, sorry if we're getting off topic. Just go
no,
ahead.
No, there is
back.
No off topic on this show.
Okay. I just remember thinking, well, on the one hand, that's a good thing because we don't want people pushed through just to make a quota. We don't want to push people through just to say, look, we're diverse. Look what we have. We want to know that, hey, everyone has made it through, has genuinely made it through. Then on the other hand, I was just kind of like, well, why not? Where did they all go? And I'm realizing, is it because women don't think they can do it, or do they not want to do it? Because I can absolutely see why you would not want to do it. I mean, the cancer rate, the suicide, the lack of sleep, trying to be pregnant. I was pregnant. I stayed online until I was like 7 months pregnant. It was not fun. It's physically harder on women. We're genuinely not as big. We're not as strong. We don't have the testosterone, so we can't recover from injuries as well. It's a lot harder on us. And I remember women in the department like, we need to keep pushing until we're 50-50. I'm like, we are never going to be 50% of the fire department. We're just not. 50% of the women in the world don't want to do it. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like saying that I think 50% of hairdressers should be men. You know, just because you want to check a box, you want to make the equation perfectly balanced. It's bullshit. There are certain jobs that seem to lean into certain areas, you know, and then the thing is, there are equal and opposite of those jobs. You know, there are people that are incredibly artistic, people that are so mathematically astute that they can figure out how to send a rocket into the, you know, to the space. None of us are made equal. Now, if there's a deliberate... Yeah, exactly. Hopefully, you know, but yeah, if there's a deliberate opposition to someone being, and then that's a whole different conversation. Another real truth that's come out of this podcast is the answer to diversity is mentorship. And I've got a friend who's got a great mentor program here in Ocala, Florida, where they've pretty much removed all the barriers to entry. So it's centrally located. They meet at the downtown station, which, you know, more often than not tends to be closer to some of the poorer areas as well. They provide free training, all the gear. There are scholarships available for Fire Academy. And then there are departments screaming for people on the back end of that. The beautiful thing about that, my stepson did it, my bonus boy, and he discovered that he didn't want to be a firefighter. Equally as important. But I think what it does is, rather than go in and scoop up, we need you know, 12 English women, go find them, you know what I mean? And the 12 there, and the some are shit and some are amazing, and you get them all. Instead, you go into an area and you challenge the underserved population to rise up and see if they can reach that bar. And of course, lots of them do. And those are the candidates that don't just fall out of the academy or orientation. Those are the ones that become great firefighters.
I think that's great. They need to know what it entails so they know if they want to do it. And there's, I'm sure there's tons of people out there that would love to do the job and just in the back of their mind, oh, I can't do that. They just don't think they can achieve it. So when you open the door like that and give them the opportunity, that's awesome.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, what about recruitment? When did you come on?
I was hired officially in 2006.
Okay. I came on in 2004. So right around the same time. This is an important conversation, I think, because we are now in 2024 sitting in a recruitment crisis, and we'll definitely get into that too. But how many people were you testing against back then?
Oh my gosh. When I took my written, there was 3,500 people. Yeah, 3,500 people. And we, out of that written, I don't know how many passed. I want to say maybe 1,200, but there was still, you know, over 1,000 people to get drawn for two different academies that had about 15 people each.
I had the exact same experience, not quite the same. I tested against 1,000 for Anaheim for 30 spots, and everyone in that room, this is obviously they've been filtered out to even be invited to test. They were all firefighter, EMTs or paramedics. A lot of them had ambulance experience, wildland experience. They'd been explorers. I mean, they've a fat, fat resume. That's who I was competing against. And they ended up taking, you know, whatever, 5% of that entire room. And so I think this is an important kind of perspective when I have people, you know, from my generation or further back even, is that's where we were. That's how far we've strayed. And now people are recruiting and they're taking everyone that tests. And they're missing the fact that just because you got a body in the rig doesn't mean you've got the right body in the rig. And we used to be able to take that top 10, 20, 25%. And then if people were lower, then they would test and get better and better, and they'd fight their way up to the top and be worthy candidates. But right now, kind of like we were saying with the diversity conversation, if you just go in and scoop everyone up, that potentially could be a terrible engineer, captain, battalion chief, or chief one day.
We like to promote people like that. We just get them off the line away from us and just, sure, promote, just get off the line, get away from us.
What possibly could go wrong?
Exactly. Just get out of here. I'm aware that there's much fewer applicants trying to take tests now. There's a crisis. And I think that that started, honestly, if you look at Santa Clara County for the number of applicants for paramedic, just plain paramedic, not even firefighter, just for the county, I want to say in 2018, 2019, it was whatever the number was, let's just say 20,000. And then it dropped down to like 2,000 by the year 2020. And my theory is, COVID was rough. All politics aside, for pro-vaccine, anti-vaccine, whatever your view is aside, COVID was rough on everyone for a lot of reasons. I just remember at one point thinking, I can't have a life outside of work, because as soon as someone was exposed, that entire shift was quarantined, and I was at a specialty station, so they didn't have a big pool of people to fill those spots. You'd go into work, you know, for your 48, and you didn't know if you were going to go home for a week or, you know, 5 days or a week. They would just hold you there because they didn't have anybody else to work. And I'm like, I can't make dentist appointments. Like I can't have a life. I can't, oh, go to that concert. I don't know. I might be getting forced back, because I was getting forced back every single 4 day. And as a single mother with my little boy, and my mom watches him, but she also works. I remember one day I was forced back the night before for a shift. Luckily someone stepped up and took it for me, and I should have just kept my mouth shut. I told the chief, hey, this person's covering it for me. Well, someone called in sick the very next morning, and I was forced back again for the exact same day. Luckily someone stepped up and covered it for me, but I really don't want to be at the mercy of kindness of others to step up and take a shift, because I had no childcare. You're forcing me back for a shift, and I didn't know what I was going to do. Yes, that's my fault. That's my drama. That's my bad life choices that put me in this situation that I didn't have childcare. But the fact that I had to find two people to cover for me for the exact same day because I was forced back, you just feel like this department doesn't care about me. They don't give a shit about me. They don't give a shit about my family, my health. Like, I'm doing the best I can here, but I literally can't have a life. I can't make dentist appointments. I can't do anything. And I think the stress that comes with that is, it's not worth it. I'm upping my risk of cardiovascular disease, of cancer, all the other known health side effects of the job. And you clearly don't give a shit about me. So what am I doing here? And I think the younger generations are aware of that. Like, why would we want that job when we know it's probably going to kill us? It's definitely going to ruin our marriage. So what's the point?
I couldn't agree more. And to turn it into a positive conversation, I mean, it is, but, you know, to end, should I say, with the positivity, I think this is the critical mass. And this is the opportunity for us to finally fix it, because now we can look back at the absolute shit show behind us and go, see, I told you it was fucking us up. You know what I mean? And all the freaking, you know, names on the memorial walls. But I mean, I had a similar experience. It wasn't COVID, but back in, when would it have been? 2013. I was a single dad, you know, and it wasn't bad life choices. It was the fact that my ex had decided that she wanted to bring someone else in the house when I was at the station. So it wasn't even like I'd screwed up and, you know, destroyed the marriage. And again, you know, I get that there's always, you know, two sides and you know, an input, as it were. But I was a single father and the same thing was happening. I was a medic and a firefighter. And, you know, I would get called, hey, you're going to be you and me four. So I'm like, you don't understand. There's a tiny human being that needs me to come home at 8 o'clock, who has school, has to be picked up, has to be fed. You know, he's got to be let in the house, those kind of things. 3-year-olds aren't super independent. So, and it ended up forcing me to change departments to a place that was, you know, down the road that I gave up any chance of fighting any fire anymore, and didn't understand at the time the complacency that was in that department. And you talk about mental health, that was probably the biggest mental ill health stressor I had in my career. But that was all because that previous department had refused to address the issues that was slowly affecting their recruitment. And so who did it fall on? Everyone who's still wearing the uniform. Well, you can't go home. Well, you can't go home. Without actually acknowledging what that looks like for that individual family and the appointments and the promises that parents have made to their children.
Mm-hmm. And I get it. I remember when I first hit the line Christmas Day and I displaced some 32-year veterans, some really old school guys that had been around for 32 years. We actually had 4 on the engine and 5 on the truck, and there wasn't enough room for me to sleep in the dorm. So I had to take a mattress and sleep in the weight room. And as the only girl, so I didn't get to sleep in the dorm. But the mentality that I grew up with is, well, this is the job. You signed up for this. Your job is to help people and to be there. And sometimes you get forced back and suck it up and get tough kind of mentality. But looking back, I walked in, I hit the line with 0 force backs. And everyone else there had about 5. Because I remember getting force back every Sunday for like a month until I caught up. We were the last class to walk in with 0. The academies after us were grandfathered in with like an average. They had to figure out a mathematical equation because the career force backs were getting higher and higher. That's just how we did force backs at the beginning. And I remember like, okay, you have 32 years on. You have been forced back 6 times. You have been forced back 6 times in 32 years. And I've just been forced back 4 times in a month. And by the time I left, I can't tell you how many force backs I had with my 17 years on. And so the point I'm trying to make is you have all these old school people that are like, suck it up and get tough. And this is the job. And this is what you signed up for. And it's not the job you signed up for. You didn't sign up to get forced back every 4 day. And we have plenty of people signing up for overtime. So it's not like we just took the overtime every time it came because we didn't know when it was going to come. No, we know it's there. It's always there. We're short people. People are getting put on quarantine. So I'm just trying to speak to the older people because I know they're out there listening and I know they're like, well, you know, this is what you signed up for. Well, it's not, because you had 30 years on with 5 force backs and I got 4 in a month. So
that's how I was in Anaheim, that same system. And the poor guys ahead of us were getting murdered. And then when we hit 6 months off probation, it was our turn. And I think my base was either side of like 60 grand. And I didn't sign up. Maybe I signed up for like 1 or 2 overtimes. That was it. But basically didn't. I wasn't that guy. I wanted to go home. And by the end of the year, I cleared $100,000 in mandatory overtime. You know what I mean?
Wow.
Almost my salary again. So, I mean, this is the problem. And again, it comes to the old guys. I remember in Orange County in Florida, the old guys were like, I was riding the rescue. Well, they never transported. They just went to the call, waited for the private ambulance, and then they went back to the station. So it's not apples to apples in some of these. Some of these guys were absolutely in the meat grinder, and they probably, you know, the Compton fire medics were probably doing just as many, if not more, than the guys today. But, you know, most of the country, yeah, it's slowly got worse and worse and worse. And that's why, you know, excitedly, I think we have an opportunity to now turn the ship around. But we've got to identify the things that have spiraled down. Otherwise, we won't have a fire service anymore. It's just that simple.
I think that we need to recognize that the fire service is not what it was 30 years ago. Well, I have 17 years, so 50 years ago, the people I got hired with that are in the retirement now barking how we're getting soft. I think we need to recognize that it's just a different fire service. We aren't running the same calls. We aren't running the same number of calls, and we're faced with different obstacles. I don't think we had medics. We don't think we did medical stuff until like the 60s, right? Do you know that stat? I want to say it was like 60 something when we brought in our first paramedics.
Yeah, I think
to actually run medical calls.
The 60s in Pittsburgh, which people dispute, but I'm actually getting the original guy, and they were black guys, which is kind of scrubbed from history. So apparently Miami-Dade and LA started the medic program, but they didn't. But in the 70s, I think was when it really started gathering steam.
Yeah, so we have people who've been around that were the old school guys, and really they didn't run many medicals. I remember them telling me stories about how they were driving around telling people, hey, if you have an emergency, like still teaching people about 911. It wasn't well known to even call 911. So I don't think it's fair that you have these old school guys that are judging the fire service now, because we run so many medical calls. We are dealing with electrical vehicles. There's just social media. There's just more stress out there. You have to be careful everything you do and say when you're out there, because everyone's got a camera and they're watching you. I don't want to say it's harder. It's just different. It's hard differently.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So actually my son and I were watching Masters of the Air, and he turned to me and goes, who do you think were the better pilots, the World War II pilots or the fighter jets of today? And I was like, well, technically, the fighter jets of today, they have the most amazing training and technology. But as far as courage and combat, the World War II boys, hands down. I mean, there's no question, because they were doing so much with so little. And it's the same thing. Both are admirable, but they're also very different.
Yeah, I think you probably had to have more technical skill, right? Because there wasn't all these automated computers to do so much stuff for you. You have more to keep track of because you have computers and you have radar. There's more to keep track of. But on the other hand, those computers are doing a lot for you in the jet, whereas the old school guys, that was all manual.
Yeah, big old metal tube and your fingers crossed.
Yeah, everything was pretty manual. So it's hard in a different way. And I joke about this with parenting. Well, I think parenting was hard back in the days when you're actually worried about feeding your child, you know, back in the early 1900s and before, all the way up to the 1900s. You worried in America, if you had enough food, you're going to starve to death. Where are you going to live? Like, you could actually die. You could actually get smallpox and die. And we don't really have those fears nowadays, but I have to worry about social media and my child being bullied 24/7 and school shootings and all the other stuff. So it's hard in a different way. And I think we all generations need to take a step back and recognize we all have our battles. We're doing the best we can.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think that, yeah, the universal push towards change is the important thing. And most of us are having human experiences. So if you kind of belittle each other's struggles, then you're not going to get anywhere. But if you actually stand side by side, then, you know, one profession can impact others in a positive way.
And the inverse is true as well, to not just stand back and judge others, but to not emotional window shop. Well, I'm okay because I'm not as bad as that person. That person is divorced and they lost a child and I'm just sitting here as a single mom. You shouldn't emotional window shop. If you have a stress, it's valid. If you're depressed about something, it's valid. You just have to learn how to get through it.
Absolutely. Well, what about your career? As you kind of walk through from probation onwards, What were some of the career calls that you responded to?
Career calls, like actual calls, not just what stations I worked at and what I did.
Yeah, no. I mean, yeah, it doesn't have to be like, I'm not saying the, you know, the thing that we dread, oh, what's the worst thing that you've seen, but what are some of the memorable rescues or, you know, incidents that you responded to?
Well, I remember one time, so my first station I was at was a pretty quiet station. I learned early to bid a crew, not a station. And I had a very, very seasoned captain and a very seasoned medic who kind of helped guide me because I was so green. And at one point I remember there's a little arsonist in the area. So I, at our quiet little station that doesn't do anything, Angela got to pump 4 structure fires in about a month, which was wonderful because the time you really want to get run is early, right? If you don't get those calls early in your career to learn things, it's okay to make mistakes and to ask questions when you have less than 5 years on. If you have 10 years on and you haven't run a lot of calls to make the mistakes or to learn the questions you need to ask, now it almost feels like it's too late. Like, well, I can't ask that now because I have 10 years on. I should know that. So I was really grateful for that. We were kind of in the middle of the department. So we were at like first or second in to most of the fires, or the first or second alarm in. Unfortunately, the really memorable calls are the horrible ones. I don't want to go too far into that, but like I've said before on another interview, I enjoy stationed visits. We had a station, that first station was kind of in a neighborhood, and I used to put on angel wings and stand out front with the rig and all the lights on and a bowl of candy on Halloween. Like I love the holidays, and no one goes by the fire station to trick or treat. So I was like recruiting trick or treaters, just pulled the rig out with my lights on. They're like across the street. And I was like, hey, trick or treat. Cause I had to have something I could take off quickly if we got a call. So I had these little angel wings on and just standing out there with my bowl of candy, trying to recruit trick or treaters. And then you hear these little kids, hey, we're going to trick or treat. Like they were super excited to come and get candy at the fire station. And I only got like 4 of them. So they got a lot of candy. So I think I, more than the calls, I really loved the social aspect and getting to know the people. I love the station visits. I like going to the schools and getting to know the little kids because they're just so cute. They're just so darn cute. Trying to think. Oh, we did have one call. A guy was, a little kid was playing hide and seek with his brother, and he got stuck in the washing machine. And it wasn't emergent. Everything's okay. We were trying to get him out. And I remember the captain going over the radio to cancel the ambulance because we didn't need it. It's like, oh, it's okay. And he's like, he's all right. He's just a little agitated, which I thought was hilarious at the time. Here's this kid is freaking out. And I'm just trying not to laugh. But I can't say I have a ton of memorable calls other than the bad ones, if that's where we're going to go.
Well, we can, obviously, we'll see, you know, where that leads us. But just going back to the Halloween thing for a moment, it's amazing, you know, I guess perception is everything. If it was a male firefighter in his civilian clothes, not next to a fire station, he'd look like a pedo.
Yes, for sure. For sure. And that's the advantage to being a female, right? I mean, every single possible delivery call, hey, EMT skill, Ange, you're up. And I was happy to do it. I mean, putting the 12 leads on, like, I get it. Women are more comfortable with other women. People are more comfortable with women around their kids in general. So we have a place. We have a strength.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's back to that diversity conversation. If someone's been sexually assaulted by a man, a female has, you know, who's the best person to put in the patient compartment? Obviously a female firefighter. So, you know, there's, you know, that's what diversity should be. You know, the broad spectrum of strengths and personalities that you have on a crew that could be an asset in that moment.
Culturally too, we have a lot of culture in Santa Clara County. And if you had a woman having some sort of a female issue or even putting the 12 leads on, they would be highly uncomfortable with another male in those general situations. They just would rather have a female.
Mm-hmm. I literally just hugged one of my wife's Muslim friends at one of her school functions. She's in med school at the moment. And the moment I did, I was like, oh, fuck, you're not supposed to do this to a woman, you know, in that culture. And luckily she was okay. And I actually found her later and apologized for my ignorance. But that would be the perfect example. Like, you know, the moment you go in, or even before, that your Muslim crew member has already kind of given you the spiel on, you know, what is deemed acceptable and not in certain cultures. So I think that's another kind of layer to what we do that's invaluable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, respecting culture, but also kind of on that note is understanding the message, right? Like, you didn't hug her to offend her. And I think a lot of that is lost nowadays. We simply look at the act and deem the act good or bad based on the act rather than on the intention of the person. And like when someone says something and, oh, that they shouldn't said that because of X, Y, and Z. It's like, but what is their intent? Are they trying to insult you? Are they trying to hurt your feelings? Are they genuinely good intention, goodwill in what they're saying, and it just doesn't quite land right? And I wish that we could find a way to get everyone to take a step back and not be so triggered and offended by everything. Just take a step back and go, is that person trying to be? Because I can tell you, how often I hear, oh, you're a fire person. And they're trying so hard to find the right word. And their intent is to be polite, and they don't know the right word. Or they'll say fireman person. They clearly like are uncomfortable. And you know what? You can call me a fireman. I don't care. My paycheck stays the same. And you're not trying to stick it to me. You're not trying to make a point. However, there are plenty of people that I worked with when they introduced themselves, they would say, I'm a fireman. And they said it with the intent of making a point. And while they may have referred to me as a firefighter and they were polite about it, the intent behind the way they said it is they were making a differentiation on purpose. And I think we've really lost that in our society of look at the intent of what someone is saying versus the word. If you're a nice older person and that's the only word you've ever known, you call me a fireman, I don't care. If you are my age and you're calling yourself a fireman and referring to me as a firefighter with a derogatory tone, I'm going to pick up on that. We really should take a step back and focus more on the intent of what people are saying rather than the actual content.
I think we need to go even a step further now and say, I am predominantly in the EMS system and occasionally I'll visit a fire. That's if we're being really transparent.
Yeah. How many fires have I got? I think the statistics now for my department are like 72 to 78% medical and like 3 fire. And that includes car fires, not just structure fires. It's not, yeah. Absolutely. I'm an emergency responder. I'm kind of a potpourri of calls.
Exactly. Jack of all trades, little Swiss Army knife. All right. Well, then walk me through the kind of journey that you had as far as your own mental health. Obviously, we're going to get to Mexico. So kind of what did those years and decades look like?
Well, I would say even before I had my son, I was just really struggling with, I had a temper. And that probably started from when I was younger. But it's one of those things like the straw that broke the camel's back. I could have been fine going about my life. And then you throw in the stresses of the job and the lack of sleep and everything that comes with it. And I was really starting to have issues where I would find myself hiding in the storage room because I could just feel for no reason at all, like I'm just losing it. And I would start to cry. So I'd have to go run in the storage room because God forbid someone finds me. And I wouldn't know why. I would just break down. And I never did it on a call. I was always able to hold it together. But clearly that's not a good way to live. I knew something was off. So went to therapy on my own. We tried cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive processing therapy, EMDR, which is the go-to for PTSD. I was officially diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, which I'm hoping we could all come together and recognize it's an injury, not a disorder. And nothing was working. I tried medication. I tried group therapy, talk therapy. Nothing seemed to work. And I just remember thinking, well, I just got to suck it up. Like I've done my whole life. You just got to suck it up and get through. And luckily I met my husband. I had my son, met my husband. And through the canine world, because he's a dog handler, he knows a lot of other dog handlers and many of them are veterans. Now the veteran community has been helping their people with plant medicines and theogenetics for about a decade. They're quite a bit further along than us with the whole operator syndrome, TBIs, and everything from being over with the war on terror. So through them, I was able to connect with a place called The Mission Within. And I flew myself down to Mexico, or flew myself down to San Diego, hopped in a van with a bunch of people I'd never met, smuggled myself across the border to go do drugs with people I'd never met. And keep in mind, I've never done drugs in my life. I think I have tried pot twice and I don't like it. So I'm not like a drug seeker trying to find the next high. But I was desperate. I had hit the point where I realized I was not a good mom. I was not being there for my son the way a mother should. I was definitely having problems with my temper and my patience, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I absolutely had suicide ideations, never had a plan. But there was days I was so far gone and just so down. I remember thinking it would just be nice. I called it mental swearing sometimes, where you just, fuck, I'm just going to off myself. Because in that moment, all the stuff that's stressing you out or causing you to be depressed doesn't matter anymore. Cool, I'm just going to do it. And all of a sudden you get this moment of relief. All that stuff that you feel like is pressure weighing on you is gone for a moment if you're like, I'm just going to do it. But then I started thinking, well, I can't leave my son behind. So what am I going to do? Do I take him with me? And instantly, like that, you just lose it. Like as a parent, you can never hurt your child. I would never hurt my child. But walking through the steps of my head of how bad am I today? Yep, that sounds like a good idea. That feels like it's relieving some pressure if I just say I'm going to do it, but then I can't leave my son. So what do I do? And it's a whole, I never had a plan. It's just a whole system I had developed to kind of snap myself out of it. It's not healthy. I don't recommend it. It's a horrible coping mechanism. But then I was like, well, nope. That all still sounds like a bad idea, so I must be okay. I must be good to go into work today because killing myself and taking my son with me still sounds like a bad idea. Yep, we're good to go. Let's suck it up and keep going. So went down to Mexico and did the plant medicine. And I have to say, it was anticlimactic. It wasn't what I expected, and that was the problem. I had expectations going into it. My great-grandmother is going to come and give me all this wisdom and it's going to be magical. Nope, that's not what happened at all. It takes a lot of work on the front end. I probably didn't put as much work in at the beginning as I should have. And it takes a shit ton of work on the back end to maintain the work. However, when I came home, nothing irritated me. Nothing pissed me off. Everything was just so present. And so right now, and nothing more than it was, if that makes sense. If something happens, a lot of times when you have stress, when you have depression or anxiety, you instantly make that incident out to be more than it is. And it was so nice to just be able to sit there and have something done or said. And it was like, it's like this saying I heard, when you're upset, think of you're the pond and your emotions are the fish. Be the pond, not the fish. And that's exactly how I felt. Like all of these emotions and things that were going on were just sort of happening. And I was just able to observe them and not get drawn into it emotionally. Like that's offensive or that's triggering me or that's whatever it is. It was an amazing place to be. And I stayed there for about a week and a half or 2 weeks. So I know the drugs were out of my system. I wasn't still high. It was an amazing, and it let me know, hey, this is how you can feel all the time when you learn to control your emotions. And I turned to my husband and I told him we need to do something about this because one, not everyone knows a special forces operator to get access to these medicines. And two, it was like $2,000 or $3,000. Not everyone has that much spare cash sitting around. When I'd done this, it was about a year after we had lost a friend of ours on a task force. He had committed suicide. He died by suicide, leaving behind two little boys. And I've lost several people to suicide over the past 10, 15 years or so. And for some reason, that one hit me. It was so close to home that we can't lose anymore. And I have a graph that I'll send you, but it's amazing when you look at the statistics for firefighter suicide. It starts, the graph that I have starts in 2000, and it doesn't bounce around up and down. It's a pretty linear climb up until today. And I want to say the numbers for today or this year or last year are about four times as high as they were in 2000. And again, it doesn't bounce around. It's a pretty nice steady climb to the point that you're more not likely not to die of suicide than by on-duty activities. So clearly we have an epidemic. Clearly there's an issue with mental health. And clearly all the modalities that are available are not enough, because I had access to more therapy modalities and more free sessions than any firefighter has in history. My department's very progressive when it comes to mental health. And yet I was still walking myself through potential suicide because I just couldn't anymore.
Going back to your own darkness first, one thing that I've heard over and over again, and maybe this wasn't the case because of the way you've described, you know, thinking about your son at that moment, but and I literally just did a post about this today. The old school way, again, going back to the old guys, was suicide is cowardly and selfish. And how could you? You left your kids behind, you know, and I get that. We all basically thought that until, you know, some of us were forced into this awakening by burying our friends. But as I've kind of listened to so many stories now from people that were so, so close, some literally holding the gun, you know, some actually went through with the attempt and they survived it. There was, you know, obviously the wanting the suffering to end was a resounding common denominator. But the other one that I'd really heard no one discuss was the feeling of burdensome, the feeling of my family will be better off if I'm not here. I'm the reason that they're hurting so much. And then when you look at it through that lens and understand that the brain is literally broken by that point, and I say broken empathetically, that their reality has been distorted. Now in that moment, suicide becomes courageous and selfless because they truly believe that they are the problem. And then you add in the fact that they've joined a profession where they're willing to risk their lives for strangers, taking a life for their own loved ones, you know, adds, I think, to that weight. Did you have that burdensome at all as you were getting through that?
Absolutely. Part of my biggest burden was knowing my mental health issues were potentially damaging to my son. I knew that if I was to go through with it, that would obviously have a significant negative impact on my son, and I didn't want to impact him like that. But I also didn't know how to stop. I didn't know how to be better. And I just felt like,
don't apologize, please.
I remember there was times I just thought, I am ruining this beautiful human being. And I just didn't know what to do because I just didn't know how to get better. I was trying everything that was given to me. And you think this is just this precious little human being and I'm ruining him. Of course, obviously killing yourself is not better, but what do you do? What do you do when you're trying everything and you still feel like a shitty mom and you still feel like you are ruining this precious little being? What do you do? And that's where I was. And I think, so my friend Troy Bazell, Captain Bazell, I know he had a back injury and I think he was looking down the barrel of getting retired out, which by the way, workman's comp is a whole other another issue we need to work on, how much stress they add and how difficult they are to work with. And I think he was in that process of maybe getting retired out. What do you do if you're in pain all the time, which causes depression? You're looking down the barrel of maybe getting retired out. So you're going to be losing a significant portion of your income and you have a family to take care of. What are you going to do? And you know that you're a burden on them because you hurt and you know that you're depressed and you know that you're probably maybe having angry outbursts and you're taking it out on your family and you're watching these precious little kids in tears because you've lost your shit again, or you're fighting with your wife because of whatever. And you're watching your family. You are the cancer. You are this toxic thing that is ruining your family. Oh, and you're in pain and you're not going to be able to provide for them. Well, at least if I kill myself, I won't be hurting them anymore like I am now. I won't be causing them to cry because I'm angry at them and I've lashed out at them for no reason. And I'm going to get them a nice bulk sum of life insurance so that they will be taken care of. And people don't see that. They just think it's cowardly. They honestly believe their family is better off without them.
Yeah, I think it's so important. I think, you know, when we talk about, oh, if you're struggling, just call me. And this is one of the comments I got in the post this morning. Oh, you know, the brain's not broken. People just need to ask for help. And like, it's not that simple.
It's
like saying, you know, all people, fat people need to do is stop eating cake. And if that was the case, we wouldn't have obesity in America, would we? They'd just stop eating cake. Right. But the environment creates, you know, is set up where people are far more likely to eat shitty food. And in our profession, the environment is set up that the access to a lot of these therapies, especially the ones that we're going to talk about, the psychedelics, you know, we have freaking prohibition laws that are literally stopping our first responders and military and civilians from accessing things that are working incredibly well. So I think that what should be on the post is if you are feeling like you are a burden to your family, that is a huge red flag. And you know, if people even talk about that around the kitchen table, that would be a great sign to, if you can find them alone for a moment, have that conversation with them. You know, open the door, be vulnerable yourself first. Don't fold your arms and look down your nose at them, but actually say, look, you know, I was kind of feeling this myself. Let me tell you about the dark place I was. Let me tell you about the drinking that's increased in my life. You know, but you mentioned about being a burden. Mate, you're not a burden. Talk to me. You know what I mean? Because I think that has to be, you know, front and center now, because I've heard it so much and I'm just a freaking lowly firefighter with a microphone.
Not a lowly firefighter. You're doing a good thing here. So thank you for that. But I think when I first started on our peer support team, we were using the critical incident stress debriefing type program, and where people could come to us, we were resources and we were able to facilitate these meetings about calls and diffuse afterwards. But I think now with the IAFF peer support program, we're trained to be more proactive, to look for people that have certain symptoms or signs that we think that they might be having an issue, and to go and out and ask them, because like I said, we suck at asking for help. And not only do we suck at asking for help when we need it, even when it's offered to us, our first reaction is usually going to be, nope, fine, to push back. So if you really do see someone having symptoms, like they think they're a burden, they're drinking more, they're just overall becoming more negative, you may have to push a little more and get them one-on-one to get them to open up and talk. The flip side to that is if you're like me, where I was going out and getting help on my own, not through the department and paying for it myself, what happens when everything legally available isn't working? That creates a whole other dynamic when it's not just I have these problems and I'm going to fix it on my own. I'm going to suck it up and be tough, because that's what we do. What if they've already realized they can't fix it on their own? They've reached out for help. They've tried everything out there, and yet they're still having these dramatic ups and downs. What happens? And I think that's where we come in.
Absolutely. Well, I've heard so many EAP horror stories where you talk about women's comp, you know, tying that all in together. And then again, if you're being forced out, talking about that, you know, that one example, you're being forced out because of an injury. Now you're not just losing, you know, your pay and all the other things. It's you've lost your tribe. You've lost your purpose, you know, and then there might even be a feeling of organizational betrayal, which is huge and another under-discussed element of mental ill health. Circling back to the graph, what also saddens me is that that's not including a single retiree. So you wouldn't be on those stats now. I wouldn't be on those stats now. So, you know, when is that most likely going to manifest? When they're sitting in that apartment on their own. Maybe their kids are grown up, or maybe they didn't speak to them after the outburst they had 5 years ago. And now, you know, they're really alone with their thoughts. So I would argue in the cancers and the, you know, heart attacks, and certainly in the mental health side, that's probably an absolute fraction of who we're actually losing, you know, as far as people that aren't actually wearing the uniform anymore, but the last 10, 20, 30 years they did.
Well, I got all my statistics from the Firefighter Behavioral Health Alliance, which is a nonprofit. So they do need donations, and it takes them sometimes 3 to 5 years to receive the reports of suicide and then to verify that they did die by suicide and that they were first responders. I don't actually know if any of the stats that I have are for active duty or retired. But I do know that they believe the stats they have are only about 60% of what's actually out there. So they're grossly underreported. And I think they have their numbers go back as far as like 1880 something. And what's interesting is when they go, and I don't know how accurate they can be that far back, I'm sure it's difficult to get the numbers accurately, but based on the numbers they have, 96% of the suicides from 1880 till today, 96% are in the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly there's something going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of that, I was on someone else's podcast a while ago, and I had just helped a friend get connected to a psychedelic experience, or, you know, psychedelic therapy in Texas. And then she said to me, oh, I've got a firefighter who, like yourself, he tried several different things, was at the end of his rope. He kind of got off alcohol, fallen back in again, and was truly, you know, very, very close to taking his own life. She connected with me with him, and I connected him to Sergio from Agape Church, who I just had on not too long ago. And the first day, kind of like yourself, he was like, this is bullshit. It's not working. The second day, and he told me this, you know, a few days after when they'd been through the retreat and he processed everything, he's like, James, over and above the birth of my child, the wedding to my wife, and getting hired as a firefighter, this was the most powerful experience of my entire life. And he went from suicidal back to, I think he's kind of blazing a trail, trying to do the same thing that you're doing as far as, you know, just locally connecting more firefighters to plant medicine. So I've watched it firsthand. Those two men specifically, I know, were suicidal, and now they're doing better than they ever had before. So talk to me about, you know, you went through that yourself. What was the creation? How did you find your own facility or the facility that you use now in Texas to keep it stateside? And then let's kind of talk about some of the success stories you've had.
So we've also had several people come through and say top three experiences of their life for sure. We've had several atheists come through and say, nope, not atheists anymore. There is a higher power. It is out there, and we're all connected. And that's a great feeling. We no longer use a local facility because we found through advice of a lawyer that going through a church doesn't necessarily protect our active duty participants, because you have to have a devout belief, and then, okay, they're going to pick the church apart. Do they have a devout belief? Who's the congregation? How, like, they go down the list of how they're going to pick it apart. So we decided to protect our active duty people by hosting ours in Mexico, because by doing these medicines in Mexico, we are not breaking any federal laws. I'm pretty sure at any point someone could go to Amsterdam when pot was still illegal here, and you can go to Amsterdam and smoke pot, and you're probably not going to lose your job because it's legal there. It's not necessarily legal in Mexico, but by doing it there and not here, you're not breaking federal laws. And that's how we protect our active duty people. That and, you know, animosity and keeping everything quiet. We don't tell anybody. Anonymity, not animosity.
That's the Freudian slip.
Yeah, animosity. I have some animosity. We'll get to that later. Through my retreat, through Mission Within, the medicine woman, if you would, she's amazing. She's from Chile. She grew up with curanderas. She's not a medicine woman, but she is the one that administered the medicine. Her grandparents were curanderas, but she lived and worked in America for 30 years in mental health. And she's a doctor, Dr. Andrea Lucy. And she worked for the NICO and Center of Excellence and did a bunch of work with military guys. And she has this really deep Western medicine background, and then just one day decided to go back to her roots, and she started holding retreats. So we use her, and she rents a house, and we provide medical screening with a doctor or nurse practitioner beforehand to make sure everyone is medically cleared, because there are some medical situations where you shouldn't be taking the medicine, or we need to take severe precautions for you. And she does all our pre-work, and we're bringing in more people because we want to make sure that people are getting enough sessions for pre-work and post-work. But then they go to Mexico for, I'd say it's 4 or 5 days, and you do psilocybin the first day, and you do the toad the second day. And they incorporate a lot of yoga and breath work and meditation. So it's not just about the entheogenics. And we say that because obviously the toad is not a plant medicine, but entheogenics is all encompassing of all of them. So we're trying to keep it as culturally respectful as possible. the people that found these medicines thousands of years ago have used them safely and successfully for thousands of years, and we want to respect that. The cultures that discover these medicines believe in the spirit of the plants and the spirit of the animals, and that's part of the healing process. You're healing your spirit, because if you think about it, everything on the planet is made up of molecules. We're all made up of, you know, carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and all these little molecules that kind of vibrate, and we just happen to get put together in the right combinations so that we can think and feel. And we are connected to everything. We're all made of the same stuff. So there is something to the vibrations and the energy in your body physically versus the energy in everything that's around you. And we like to respect that. We believe it creates a better setting. It creates a healthier, more constructive setting, because you'll hear people in this world of plant medicine, entheogenics, psychedelics, talk about set and setting. What is the difference between taking a bunch of mushrooms in the forest with your buddies versus doing it medicinally to heal your mind? The difference is the set and setting, the mindset you have going into it, which takes a lot of work if you're doing it for healing, and the setting. Are you safe? Where are you physically? So we try to create not only a physically safe environment, but a spiritually aware one, if you will, to be aware of the energy of everything around you. And we do think it adds for a more in-depth and richer experience.
What is your perspective then on the prohibition laws at the moment?
I think people fear what they don't know. And I think that the government did a great job with the war on drugs into scaring people away from anything deemed a drug at the time, which is amazing to me that people are afraid to take something natural like a mushroom, but yet you'll pop those man-made pills like nobody's business, and all the side effects of, you know, nausea, death, liver secretion issues, anal leakage, erectile dysfunction, like the list is ridiculous with some of the side effects from these medicines. Why is it okay to take a drug that is man-made and synthetic with copious amounts of side effects and not something natural that God just put on this earth? Why is that not okay? It's a cultural mindset. We've been trained to believe that drugs given by doctors are good and drugs that grow out of the ground are bad. And I think it's a cultural shift that we need to change. And I think the only way to do that is to, we have studies, there's studies right now for Stanford and Harvard and Johns Hopkins, and they're all doing studies that are showing these medicines are working as good, if not better, than everything that's out there. And I think that proof, when you throw someone in an MRI machine or whatever the machine is that scans the brain for activity, and you can see all these parts of the brain light up when you're on plant medicines and how it's helping with neuroplasticity and it's helping create new neural pathways. And that is how you get better. Because why are you depressed? Why are you anxious? Because you have a thought process that is unhealthy. You have a habitual thought process that is unhealthy. When one thing happens or one thing is done or said, you go through a certain mindset. We call it the neurons that fire together, wire together. Kind of like the muscle memory of your body. When you walk, you don't think about it. It's a muscle memory. It's the same thing when you think. It's super effective for keeping you alive and being energy efficient. It really sucks when you have to change it to get healthy. And the plant medicines helps that. They call it shaking the snow globe. You have all these tracks in the snow, but those tracks are unhealthy. And it's really easy to slide back into those habitual thought patterns. And the plant medicines kind of shake the snow globe, give you a nice layer of snow to make a new set of tracks in. That's why it takes so much work before and after, because you want to make sure once you have this pliable, soft putty in your brain that you are set up to rewire it in a better way. I've said it before, but I joke that imagine your brain has like a Charles Barkley golf swing. It's going to take a lot of work and effort to get that back on track, to be healthy. And the best way to do that, honestly, even if you're not into mushrooms, gratitude. The second you hear yourself judging somebody or having a negative thought, stop, focus on your breath, and think of something positive. That is actively rewiring your brain to be more positive, because depression means you're focused on the past. Anxiety means you're worried about the future. You're not focused on you right here, right now. And you have to learn how to listen to your body. Most people are sitting around, especially firefighters. I guarantee you most of the day they have their shoulders in their ears and they're unaware of it. They have tension in their body that they're completely unaware of until you start to get an ache or a pain. Once you're at a 7 in pain, now you're going to listen to that part of your body. The key for meditation and breath work and yoga and walking out in nature is to check into your body when it's earlier. You want to be able to, I don't know why I have fireworks on my screen right now. I don't know what I did to make that happen, but that's awesome. That was perfect timing. Yes. the whole point of the plant medicine and incorporating all the tools and work you're putting in before and after is to wire your brain to be more aware of yourself. You want to catch your negative thought, your depression, your anxiety when you're at a 2. You don't want to catch it when you're spiraling out of control because now your tools aren't going to work. You need to be able to use those tools to reground yourself, to find gratitude, to find your breath when you're at a 2 or a 3. And that's what the plant medicine does, is it helps rewire your brain, one, to be more aware of your body when you're starting to spin, and to have the muscle memory to bring you back on track and find something positive. That was a really long, wordy way of explaining it, but I feel like there's just so many technical details. It's hard to get together in a short soundbite.
No, that's perfect. I just want to figure out how do you make the fireworks happen.
That was awesome. You do with how do you do that? That's something else I learned in Italy. In Italy, you learn to talk with your hands. I actually saw a guy step out of a phone booth because he was trying to use his hands and there wasn't enough room in the phone.
Well, you mentioned about neuroplasticity and regeneration. I mean, I've heard some really exciting things about psilocybin, specifically when it comes to the TBI side. But also, I think, you know, growing up in an era where I was taught, you know, once the brain is damaged, there's irreversible damage, you know, and, you know, a lot of the kind of leaning into alcoholism, obesity, well, that's just genetics, nothing I can do. And now we're really, thank God, we're actually kind of discovering, like, that's absolutely bullshit. It's, you know, much more likely to be the environment that you were raised in. If you were given KFC 5 times a week, that's probably, you know, more of an impact on your obesity than your genetics, but it's, you know, family to family. You know, that's how their parents taught them to eat, et cetera, et cetera.
And depression, like, honestly, depression, like, that makes you gain weight because my food does love me. I get instant gratification when I eat that donut.
Absolutely. That's
hard to untrain.
100%. So then, you know, what's so beautiful though is the converse occurs as well. So if we're able to kind of reset, shake the snow globe, as you said, your brain has the ability to rewire. Even if you have 3 generations of alcoholism before you, doesn't mean that you and your children are destined to follow the same path. So hearing about the epigenetics now, how they're realizing that DNA can literally be reprogrammed, that synapses can literally reform. I just, a perfect example of the miracle of the human body. I just had a CrossFit athlete on the show, and she had a blockage in her arm, which was chronic, and her body had actually created another blood vessel around the blockage. And she ended up having, you know, the clot got worse and during a competition, so she finally discovered it. But when they went in, they were like, you literally have an entire blood vessel that shouldn't be there. That is the miracle of the human body if you give it the mm-hmm. chance to actually heal.
And on top of that, you have to give it everything it needs to heal, right? The right nutrition, the right micronutrients. I'm actually getting I'm in a certification program through UCSD for integrative nutrition. It's awesome. We're learning about the science of all that and how it affects the body. And I say that because for someone who's been in our position, police, fire, high chronic stress, lack of sleep, sometimes you damage the vessel, right? Sometimes your cortisol is just off the charts, or you've burned out your adrenal glands and it's not high enough and your testosterone's low and there's all these other hormonal issues. And it's important to have the good nutrition to help make sure the vessel, your body, is able to repair itself, because you can do all this work with plant medicine and you can do all the meditation and the breath work and try to rewire your brain. It's still going to be really hard to have energy and be happy if hormonally your body is just jacked up from lack of sleep and poor diet and all those other physical factors. So we have to treat the body as a whole. It's not just about your mind and your mental health practices. It's also about your sleep and your diet and all the other aspects. It all comes together to make you function in the right way so you can heal. I forgot where I was going with that, but we're going to leave it there.
Well, speaking of helping then, so you mentioned about, you know, finding the retreat in Mexico. Talk to me about your actual nonprofit, and then let's talk about some of the success stories that you've seen.
So our actual nonprofit, we are the Siren Project, and it stands for supporting initial responders with entheogenic networking, basically. So we raise the money and we pay Andrea, and she basically facilitates everything for us. It's kind of how we keep ourselves out of it. We aren't buying the drugs. We don't grow the drugs, the medicine. We don't do any of that. She hires a legit shaman. He actually grows the mushrooms. He harvests the toad venom and all these medicines. So we know where it comes from. We know who's handled it. We know that it's safe. And I feel like that's one of the dangers in this world, is you have all these people who are going to step out on the underground and say they're serving medicine. And one, do they know what they're doing? And two, what are they actually giving you? Where did it come from? And what is it? So it makes us feel comfortable to know that we know the person who's growing it and where it comes from. So we pay for everything. All we ask people to cover is their airfare. We found if people don't have some skin in the game, they may bail last minute. So if they paid for their own plane ticket, but we cover everything else, including the house, the food. I got a thumbs up. This is awesome. I got to figure out how I make all these things pop up on the screen.
Emojis are going crazy.
I know. I wish people listening can see all this cool stuff we're making the screen do. No idea how I'm doing it. So yes, we raise the money. Of course, we always need more funds. We are funded through 2024 and part of 2025. But right now I have a wait list of about 50 people. And each retreat is we do 7 at a time. That's a good, comfortable number to get everyone through. So yeah, we fund the retreats. She rents the house. We have a doctor and a nurse practitioner present during the medicine in case there's a medical issue. We have IVs for people to take after the mushrooms just to help them recover faster. Let me see what else. Oh, we have several individual and group therapy sessions before and after, because part of the medicine isn't just the work you're putting in and the medicine you're taking, it's the community you're building. And we firmly believe that the medicine works best when you're in a group of people, of like-minded people. So everyone that goes to these retreats are either first responders, dispatchers, or spouses. We do fund spouses as well, because we've found, I'm sure everyone knows, that sometimes your wife or husband might take a beating from their first responder who's been going through post-traumatic stress or just the job itself, and they're the support network. And then when their first responder gets healed and they're fixed, now all of a sudden the spouses have time to focus on themselves rather than trying to make sure that everything's okay so that their loved one isn't stimulated. They have a time to focus on themselves, and they realize there's a huge void and they themselves need healing. And we want to heal the whole unit, not just the first responder.
Love it. What about success stories? I know you got some testimonials on the site.
We have some testimonials. My favorite is, of course, the atheists who walk in there and they leave like, nope, not an atheist anymore. We've had several people who said this was basically their last ditch effort. If this didn't work, they were probably going to off themselves. And to see them thriving, like happy individuals. One guy's getting back together with his wife. Like they were divorced and now they're getting back together. And that's just always good to hear, because not only are we helping these people heal themselves so that they don't die by suicide, we're helping heal their families. Their, you know, marriages are being brought back together. People are believing in a higher power. Of course, I can't name anybody to get too specific, but it has been an amazing, it's only been 2 years, and it has been overwhelming and scary and stressful and yet amazing at the same time. And I'm just hoping we can continue, keep going. We just need more donations.
Well, that being said then, where can people find you and donate?
So our website is thesirenproject.org. No dots, no dashes. And on the website, there's PayPal, there's Zelle, our mailing address if you wanted to mail a paper check. Again, each participant costs us about $2,000, which That's the other benefit to doing it in Mexico is things are more affordable. We're keeping it culturally respectful. We're respecting the culture of the medicine, and it's significantly more affordable. The place in Texas we used to use and several other places in the States are running about $5,000 to $7,000 per person. And I just feel like everything's so expensive nowadays. If someone's going to be willing to donate their money, I have to be a good steward. And if I can save three people by sending them to Mexico, that's what we're going to do. So we are keeping it as economically sound as possible. So thesirenproject.org.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I want to go to some quick closing questions before we let you go, if that's okay.
Okay. Yes.
First one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Yes. The first one I always tell people about is How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan. It's a great intro into psychedelics. He was just like me. He'd never done drugs in his life and then just decided to go out and try them all and write a book about it. So it really breaks down the science of the default mode network, which is that hardwired highway between your lizard brain and your prefrontal cortex. That's the one that's messed up or corrupt, and that causes a lot of anxiety and depression, and talks about how plant medicines help you circumvent that. So it's a great intro. Fantastic Fungi is a show on Netflix. It's not a book, but I love it because it talks about the intelligence and the science behind mushrooms and fungus. And this one guy is just self-taught and he figured out how to kill termites with a fungus. It's pretty amazing. And then the other book I like is The Body Keeps the Score. I think it's an interesting read for people who I think everyone has trauma. That's my personal belief. We've all been through something and it leaves its mark on you, and it can have severe long-term effects if you don't deal with it. And I think this book goes into research and science to prove that, hey, these kids who were abused as children that we had so much sympathy for are the ones who grew up and they're doing drugs and they're homeless. And they're having all these other issues. And now we're not as sympathetic for them because why can't they just get it together? Politics aside, it's just the science behind the psychology and how damaging trauma can be, especially when you're a child and you don't have any of those coping mechanisms in place, or at least not healthy ones, how damaging they can be. I think that's important for everyone to be aware of when we're dealing with other people in our society, to be well aware of for themselves. Like, you have these aches and pains physically, where is that coming from?
I've said this quite a few times in interviews recently. I think what's missing in the first responder mental health conversation is hope. And I think that when you hear the stories of post-traumatic growth, that is so inspiring to then really try and find solutions. Because the only difference between someone who's my age that, you know, is suicidal at this point and myself is just the, you know, the Russian roulette that was our lives leading up. And I've talked about, you know, some of my traumas early on, nearly dying in a house fire when I was four, and my parents' divorce and some other things. But equally, there was growing up on a farm. My dad was a veterinary surgeon, so I watched him heal animals. I was in nature. You know, I mean, we ate around a family table and we were a big family, just kind of like the Italian thing. So there were those natural elements as well. So by pure chance, I kind of had post-traumatic growth from some of the shitty things, like ongoing. That then fosters resilience. That makes you a better military member, first responder, doctor, nurse, whatever it is. And so, as you said, we all have trauma. I had Eric Potter out on the show. He's the chief psychologist for the Navy SEALs, and he refers to them as struggles. He's trying to get away from trauma specifically. But if left unaddressed, you know, there's a Mexican proverb, they try to bury us. They didn't know we were seeds. You know, if you push it down, it will come out eventually. But if you address it, then it becomes that kind of Japanese philosophy, you know, where they use the gold glue to fix the ceramics. Now it's a strength. You're even better than you were before. So rather than saying, oh, we've got to smash the stigma, we're fucking there. We're already there. Now let's talk about the hope that's on the other side of people's struggles and give them the entire smorgasbord of tools. So it might be psilocybin and a therapy dog. It might be EMDR and a hiking retreat. Whatever works for that person, they are fully aware that not only will that tool help them get there, but the other side is somewhere extremely exciting for them.
I do think that these entheogenics are hope. I think they were hope for me when I tried everything. But just to step back a little bit about the retirees and people who have to retire out because of injury, I think in our line of work and in military and several others, there's that whole who am I now aspect. When we talk about the hope, like what hope do I have if I am a firefighter? This is what I am, not just what I do. And you define yourself by this title and now it's gone, either because you retired out and now who are you? Or like Troy, you might have been forced to retire out. He killed himself in his Class B uniform. So clearly he defined himself by the job and he was looking down the barrel of not only am I going to lose my income and not be able to support my family, he was losing his identity. And I think that's where that hope comes in. We need to find a way to help our brothers and sisters find the hope in anything. Who are you outside of this? Get a hobby that is not related to the fire service. Define yourself as something that is healthy and constructive and that's never going to go away. I'm a mom and I'm a pretty good mom right now. That's never going to go away. And I think that that's part of the hope aspect. You need to have something to look forward to that isn't the job. Don't define yourself by this. And hopefully these medicines can open a door, not only to a new self-definition, but to just a better future in mental health for everyone.
I think it would, I'm assuming it would also help with creativity. And this is one of the things, just going back to the work week for a moment. One of the pushbacks I get is, well, if we just give them more time off, they'll just, you know, work overtime, you know, and if you...
No, they're isolated.
Yeah. So just reverse engineer. If you staff your fire department properly and recruitment is good and people are vying for those spots, overtime then will come few and far between and they'll have more days off. What that then does from the identity piece is it really creates space for someone to be creative and actually go, you know what? I love woodworking. I think I'm going to start installing cabinets or landscaping or painting or coaching, you know, whatever it is. And now you're adding another layer of identity to that individual. And then they're far less likely to go, all I am is a firefighter. No, I'm a firefighter and I'm a football coach or I'm, you know, whatever it is, personal trainer. So I think by giving our responders more time off and then giving them the mental space to be creative again, maybe through psychedelics, now you're setting these people up, whether it's they get fired, whether they get hurt, or whether they retire, they have something healthy to transition into.
Absolutely. When you were starting to say more time off, I was thinking like time off from work as far as like off for workman's comp with mental health issues. And I was like, I don't know if that's a good idea because those people tend to isolate and that might make it worse.
Yeah, no, the opposite. Give them time to actually fill it with something else that's exciting.
Right. And make friends outside the fire service. I learned once I got retired out that, wow, after 17 years, most of my social interactions were at work. And once that was gone, I was like, wow, I don't have much of a social life, do I? I'm not a super social person anyways, but wow. So it's harder to make friends as an adult outside of work, just random moms at school. But I would say definitely find a hobby that's outside with other people to make friends that aren't firefighters.
Yeah, absolutely. The cops say the same thing. You know, you got to get outside that. All right. Well, then another closing question for you. You mentioned Fighting Fungi, which is obviously a show. Is there a person that you recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
Andrea Lucy. She just has such a rich background in both the culture and in Western medicine. She can speak both languages. And she's an empath. She just has a great read on people like instantly. And just such a pure individual. I would highly recommend, and I'm pretty sure she'll do it. She's done it before, but she has so much more knowledge when it comes to the medicine than I do. I don't have the depth of knowledge as far as the spirit side for sure, or the science side. I would absolutely recommend her. And then maybe my husband, when he retires, he's very well spoken. He just can't be public yet until he's retired because his department's kind of conservative.
And he said, is he a USAR dog handler then?
He is. He's a fire captain. And he, that's actually how we met on a FEMA task force team. So he does search and I did hazmat. So we have four dogs. I joke. We have two that find you if you're alive and two that find you if you're not.
Brilliant. All right. Well, then the last question before, you know, I would let you go. What do you do to decompress these days?
I ride my horse. Oh my gosh. You have to be so present and so aware of your body, because animals in general, like, they communicate just fine and they don't speak a single word. They use, you know, an ear flick or a tail swish or body position. And you have to really be aware of your body and what you're doing and how you're breathing, because they pick up on all of it. And it's almost like a form of meditation, because I could honestly get killed on that horse. He could spook, we could have a bad communication, something could happen and I could really get hurt. So that is what I do to diffuse. I go out with my horse, and equine therapy is a thing, and it is my absolute sanctuary to go out there and be with him and just kind of feel and breathe and to work with him. And my other go-to is walks in nature. That kind of incorporates a little bit of the EMDR part, the left and the right and the left and the right, and just enjoying the nature, even if it's raining, and being present. Those are my go-tos for when I'm really stressed. And what we're trying to teach our son every night, we do three things we're grateful for. Even if we're mad, even if we're upset, you should always be able to find three things you're grateful for. Create that habit at the end of the day. One of our guys we work with has a board up on the wall. So as they go by and they think of things they're grateful for, they write it up on the board for the day. So I would say gratitude practice and getting out in nature.
Beautiful. Have you ever heard of a horseman, Buck Brannaman?
Yes, I have.
I had him on the show. I watched from the back end of one of his clinics, and then we did part of the interview face-to-face, and then we actually had to finish it off remotely because of time. But I mean, what a beautiful insight into, you know, trauma, and then how that connection can be a mirror to the rider. Same with a canine.
It's absolutely a mirror. And if you don't deal with your stuff, that animal's going to make you deal with it, because it's not going to work. It'll absolutely come out in the horse. And what's so amazing about him is he is the picture of every little motion he does. He is intentional. He's so aware of his body and his breathing and everything he does, and that it is communicating something to that animal. It's a beautiful partnership.
Absolutely. Well, Angela, I want to say thank you so much. It's been such an amazing conversation. You know, again, I have so much respect for anyone who comes on here and is vulnerable. I think we need that vulnerability. And I truly believe that is courage. That is strength, actually opening up. But also what you and your husband have done as far as taking that experience and then applying it to help others. So I want to thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you so much for having us.